Well, welcome once more to the Big Red Bench here on Cork's Good Times Red FM. Dan Casey here with you for the next hour, keeping you up to date with all the latest Cork sporting action as well as further afield. Huge congratulations to Russell Rovers, who are headed to Croke Park to play in the AIB All-Ireland Club Junior Hurling Championship Final as they got through their semi-final in comfortable style, I will add, earlier today. And we're keeping a pure Cork for the first segment on our show as we hear now from Erica O'Shea. The Macroom native recently won the AFLW Premiership once more with the North Melbourne Kangaroos. And here she was in conversation with the very own Ger McCarthy.
Right here on the Big Red Bench, it is a real thrill to be joined by 2024 AFLW Premiership winner and former Cork Ladies Football senior player, North Melbourne Kangaroos, Erica O'Shea. Erica, it is lovely to talk to you. How are things?
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I've been keeping well now. Just back home a few days, so suffering from jet lag, definitely.
Yes, and I will not keep you on too long because of your poor misfortune, a bit of jet lag and you're having to speak to me. Look, for those who don't know you, you are a former Cork Ladies senior footballer, but you've been out in Australia for 3, maybe 4 years now, playing for the North Melbourne Kangaroos. And this past season, and just recently, as the 30th of November, as recently as then, you defeated the Brisbane Lions in the grand final to win the franchise's first ever AFLW Women's Grand Final. Congratulations on that, because you're not out there that long. The franchise isn't that. It's on your own since 2019, I think. A fantastic achievement. And has it all sunk in, Erica, just what you've achieved this year?
To be honest, no, it hasn't hit me yet, I suppose, because I had a team holiday straight after and I'm only just realising now that we actually won, because everything's just been so hectic. But no, it was incredible, and to be able to experience that over there, like, it was something I never thought I'd be able to achieve. I suppose it was never the goal, but yeah, to be able to achieve that was just incredible.
And North Melbourne Kangaroos went through the entire season undefeated, Erica. That is a unbelievable achievement considering the quality of teams that now play at the top level in the AFLW.
Yeah, we're actually the first team between the men's competition and the women's to go undefeated for a full season. So even to write that in history was very cool. And on top of it, we were the first time that we won it in the club in North Melbourne. So we're making history in the club as well. It's just, yeah, it's cool to say.
I know from my conversations with Mike Curran, a man you know very well, and everybody in AFLW circles in Ireland knows very, very well, the sheer growth of popularity, the number of Irish players. We're up over 30 Irish players. Yourself and Vicky Wall represented North Melbourne this year, but it just seems to be rising and rising, the number of Irish players going out there to play AFLW.
Yeah, it's getting bigger every year, and it's honestly like great to see. I think every girl that comes over has such an impact into the AFLW competition, and we bring that like competitive edge from Gaelic, and yeah, every year it's getting bigger and bigger, and I just can't wait to see more girls come out in the future.
The lifestyle, Erica, the professional lifestyle, the fact that you signed a contract, you know, and the contracts, I know there was a bargaining agreement last year, a momentous and historic occasion for the men's and women's game in AFLW in Australia. You're paid as a professional athlete while you're over there. I mean, that is the stuff of dreams. It's what you wanted to do when you went over there first. Talk to me about what's a typical week, you know, for a professional player in the middle of the season. What kind of things and demands are on you?
Yeah, it's a very busy schedule. We have an app that like would have everything written down to a T, which is really handy, I suppose, because everything can get so busy. But an average schedule would be like, we go in on like a Monday evening and we just do a bit of reviews, because we'd have a game the weekend before. So we would have a review from like around 3 o'clock. We go in, wouldn't finish till like 7:30, and we'd have team meetings and we'd have dinner made for us then. And the next day we'd be in from 7 o'clock until maybe 7:30 until about 3 or 4. Like, it varies every week depending on what time of the games are at the weekend and stuff like that. But yeah, it's very full on schedule. So we have Monday and Tuesday, we'd be all in all day. We'd have a Wednesday off, be in all day again on Thursday. And we'd have a half day on Friday and then the game of the weekend. That would be the average schedule anyway.
Is
but
it,
yeah, it yeah. takes its toll.
It does take its toll. Is it everything you hoped it would be, though, Erica? It's an obvious answer. No, you're after winning the Premiership. So, yes, I understand that. But from a personal point of view, it's not an easy thing. You were very young when you went over to Australia first. I remember we talked to you here on the Big Red Bench about that big leap, going to the other side of the world on your own without your family. But has it it's obviously worked out on the pitch, but off the pitch, is this everything you'd hope for?
Yeah, definitely. I think this year now was a year that I actually really struggled being away from home a lot more than the last couple of years, which was, surprising, I suppose, when I first went out. I found it, all so exciting and so new. Obviously, I was very young. But I think this year, I don't know what hit me, but I really, really struggled. And my parents actually flew out mid-season for me, and it really, really helped me, to be honest. I think they knew I was finding it, difficult out here, and they came over, and I definitely wouldn't have been able to maintain my place in the team and stuff without them. They made a huge difference to me when I came out, and I definitely owe everything to them. And to be able to get the medal, it was definitely them getting the medal, not me.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because the number of years, for you still, homesick is a natural thing to feel. You hear about it, young professional footballers, male and female, going to England from Ireland and they feel very homesick. Being homesick there is one thing. Being homesick in Australia is a completely different thing. It is great for you, though, that you have the support of your family. I know how much Maria and your dad, John, obviously, I have to ask, is John still your agent, and is he planning on actually, taking a full-time position with North Melbourne Kangaroos? He's over there so often.
Yeah, I'm thinking it already. He still calls himself my agent, but he actually keeps saying to me every single day now I've been home, he says, my 3-year plan is worked. He said, my 3-year plan. I have a big long-term plan as well, and I'd be laughing at him. He says, I had a goal from the start, which was to win a Premiership. He has it all written down, so... Yeah.
Well, it's great to hear that. Look, they obviously love and support you, as do your sisters, Rachel, Carla, and your brother, John, who I know well from his work with the Echo. But having them there on the final day for the Premiership and to be there, as you said, to receive, that was obviously a very lovely moment for you. Because I remember you told me before, at the end of every game in the early days, a lot of the Australian players would go to their families to the side of the pitch. You didn't have that experience. But what did it mean to have them there, having beaten Brisbane in the final this year?
Yeah, no, it actually meant the world to me. To be able to have them there and go over to them after the game is something that I'll never take for granted again, having my parents at a game like that. And, just be able to celebrate the win with them. It was something that I'll never forget.
The other thing is, you won this year by beating Brisbane, and the year before you had suffered defeat in the grand final to that team. So obviously the target was to get back and go one better this year. But was that extra motivation, the fact that you were facing Brisbane in the final?
Yeah, I think it definitely drove us on a lot more this year. I think in the preseason, we had a really good preseason where everyone got really, really fit. I was the fittest I've ever been, and so was a lot of the other girls. And I think we always did it with the mindset that we said we wanted to try beat Brisbane again in the grand final. And I think we just, on the big stage, you either freeze or it drives you on. I suppose we was a big game like that. And we were lucky that we used it as fire and we were able to change that and just absolutely rip into the game. And yeah, it definitely drove us on losing. I think it was the best thing that could have happened for us.
How much of a role, you mentioned your family, but how much of a role is your coach, Darren Crocker, played in this? I know what respect you have for him, but not just this year, but just in the background and making you into the player that you are. How important a role has he played?
Yeah, Crocker plays a huge role. I think I've even learned so much off him, and even as a coach, the way he approaches things is just, amazing. I think he's a father as well, and he makes it known in the team that he wants to be a parental figure as well for us. He wants to be able to help the girls if they need it on and off the field, and he's so approachable. I think that's something that is just really important, especially for the girls away from home. And even the way he coaches is just he comes in with a mentality of he brings so much calmness, even though we could be under severe pressure. And the grand final last year, I've never, in my last 3 years of playing in the club, I've never once heard Croc raise his voice. He's just the most relaxed man, and he's just very supportive. And I think to be able to get the best out of players, he comes in with the approach that everyone needs to be supported and just feel heard and listened to. And I suppose that's something that he just wants everyone to feel, and he definitely gets the best out of players. I've learned that.
You also have Vicky Wall, the former Meath All-Ireland winner, in with you at North Melbourne. Home partner has she been to you?
Yeah, Vicky was an unbelievable player this year. I think she came in from the Rugby Sevens, which was an incredible achievement as well. And to be able to come over and come back into the sport and like approach the way she did it unbelievable, had a great season. I think our tackling went through the roof from the Rugby Sevens as well. So she was great to have in the team, definitely.
You've mentioned before in interviews that North Melbourne are like your second family. That panel and that squad is obviously very tight. You've been through a lot for such a young franchise, going so well last year and now winning again this year. Has that helped, obviously, the transition that you could call upon players and Australian players while you're over there and that you've become close with them?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what Croc always says. He's trying to build a good culture before building a good team. He wants girls have like that close knit kind of off the field, and he definitely achieved that, and he thinks that's how we were able to win and have a success, because we were all such a close team. We did so much off and on the field for each other, and just to be able to celebrate that win together like as like a family was unbelievable.
Life is good for you right now. You're full time. You're signed up for another 2 years with North Melbourne. Over in Australia, you'll be heading back early next year. Can I ask you, you left behind a Cork LGFA senior inter-county career. How difficult at times has that been when you're watching from afar and you're seeing the girls? Because I know the likes of Orla Farmer, the two Kylies, Dara and Emma, were over to visit you recently, former players themselves and current players. But how often would you keep tabs on the Cork LGFA seniors? And, you know, how difficult was that, you know, to leave that?
It was definitely a very difficult decision to leave the Cork setup. It was something that I always dreamt of being a part of, and I'll never take it for granted. It was an unbelievable experience I had with the girls. And even having the Kylies and the girls visit me over in Melbourne, like even come to a few of the games and just meet up with them, it was unbelievable. Like even the connections you make with the girls, and I definitely keep tabs on all of them, and I'd be watching their games and stuff, and always supporting the girls no matter what. And yeah, I hope to be a part of the team in the future, definitely, because I'd love to win in All-Ireland before the end of my sport and career in general. But yeah, I have to always support the girls. There's a great bunch of youth coming through, and they're going to be a really, really exciting team in the next couple of years.
They certainly are, and I know that Joe Carroll, who's the new Cork manager, is somebody you know quite well as well from your time in, working with the colleges and working with Cork LGFA underage.
Yeah, Joe is an incredible coach. He put in such hard work over the last couple of years, and he gets the best out of so many players, and he's really, really going to change Cork Irish football in the future. I think he's going to be a great asset to the girls, and I think everyone's so excited that he's on board. And yeah, I'm so happy for him, because I would have been by Joe for a good few years, and he definitely excelled me as a player hugely, and I'm so grateful that I was able to have been coached by such an amazing mentor, I suppose.
Indeed. Look, you're home for Christmas. You're back in Macroom with the family. I presume John has everything organised, and Maria's just, you know, doing as she's told at this stage, because he seems to organise everything for you at this stage. But how nice is it to get, I suppose, when you are home, apart from the jet lag, to get to spend a normal Christmas at home is a big thing for you, I would imagine, Erica, when you're away for so long in the year.
Yeah, definitely. I'll never take anything for granted like that anymore. Even coming into Macroom again, I used to kind of like live like with a mindset saying that I can't wait to get out of where I grew up. And I don't know why I used to be like that, because now I absolutely love every moment. I love seeing everyone. I love spending every day at home when I'm at home. And yeah, definitely never take anything for granted like that again. And to be able to have Christmas now at home, it's the best feeling ever. I have all my family around me. And yeah, I'm really lucky.
You are indeed very lucky, but you deserve every bit of it, Erica. I'm just so delighted for you. All the injuries in the last couple of years as well that you've endured to keep going, to make a name for yourself in one of the most competitive professional female sports out there, the AFLW, to win a premiership with North Melbourne is a fantastic and an incredible achievement. I hope you get the accolades from that you deserve. But get over Christmas first, I suppose, would be the thing at home, and make sure John doesn't do too much work, and tell him I'm very interested. We might even get him onto the Big Red Bench to talk about this long term plan that he's got. I'm very, very interested to hear the details of that. But for now, continued success to you, Erica. All the best in 2025. And listen, thanks so much for joining us here on the Big Red Bench.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, huge congrats to Erica. Some achievement there. Now to a bit of rugby, and big fans of the Big Red Bench, the All 10 of you, will enjoy this crossover as I teamed up with host of the Sunday show, Sarah McKenzie Foley, to talk Munster after they lost in disappointing style on a scoreline of 16 points to 14 to Castra in the Champions Cup last night. Enjoy this one. We're delighted to be joined here on the Big Red Bench, well, with someone who's no stranger to it anyway, Sarah McKenzie Foley. How are you getting on?
I'm good, thanks, Dan.
You're getting on fine normally, but as a Munster fan, you must be feeling it at the moment after that last night's disappointment against Castra in the Champions Cup.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a vintage Munster performance, definitely. It was very much the opposite of what I saw in Thomond Park last Saturday against Stade Francais. Now, Castra did make 12 changes to their team from their round one game. They do have a very strong home record, but I think the consensus before the game certainly was that Munster would have been expected to win.
Yeah, just from a casual watching of rugby, Munster weren't great. Castor were just really there for the take, and Munster just never showed up.
Yeah, the composure and the flow seemed to be missing from Munster last night. The line speed, the confidence was kind of lacking consistency. Sometimes it was very on point. Other times they looked nervy, not switched on. The second Castor try, for example, there were multiple Munster players with their back to the ball, which is unlike them. You know, the set piece was inconsistent. There were a lot of, I suppose the positive maybe is that it could have been a lot worse, actually. Castra missed a couple of their kicks and Munster did get a good few get out of jail free cards, but you definitely wouldn't be looking to repeat a performance like that. And I think obviously the extra injuries as well don't help in a season where we've already got quite a long injury list as well.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for the two Hodnett tries, which were, I would say, lucky to be fair, Munster might have been scoreless, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the substitutions did have a positive impact. I think Munster kind of found their flow a bit more when the second round of subs particularly came on. It might be an indication as well. We had a couple of players coming back to start last night that had been out for a while, so it could be the case that they need some time to kind of get back to their best. And the team did have 2 days off at the start of this week despite playing a Friday night game. And I think it's common enough across all sports, like sometimes actually having less game time can negatively impact you. So it would be interesting to see whether that was the case. And as you said, it could definitely have been a lot worse. John Hodnett was, despite a bit of luck, he definitely got through a huge amount of work and was probably the best player out there for Munster last night.
A man who's come in for an awful lot of flack off the back of that game is Jack Crowley. What did you make of his performance?
Again, just sort of out of sorts, I would say, like not on form. He missed touch on multiple occasions, including obviously, you know, the last kick of the game. I think all in all, he'll have been particularly disappointed with that, with his kicking from hand. I think he did front up well physically, which is something that Sam Prendergast has on occasion been criticised for not doing that. So I think if we're feeding the beast that is the debate between those two players, I think Crowley still probably has the edge on Prendergast there. But you definitely, you know, if you're Simon Easterby looking at these games and looking for consistent performances ahead of the Six Nations, I think that game for Jack last night would be one to forget.
You do think he ranks among the top between himself, Prendergast and Frawley? Who do you think is going to be starting that first Six Nations game?
I think a lot will come down to Leinster. Obviously Leinster haven't played their round two game yet. I think we'll have to see how that goes, and also the derby as well, the interprovincial, just after Christmas. I think that'll be a really, really huge kind of tipping point in that debate, because you're right up against each other there, and Frawley it looks likely to be picked elsewhere for Leinster. So for me, he's sort of out of the conversation at the minute, unless he's there in obviously a support capacity as a sub. But I think it's definitely down to Crowley and Prendergast, and I do, to be fair, think Crowley in his overall game has the edge. I think it's easy as Prendergast to be an impact sub to come in and sort of set the game alight after 60 minutes for Ireland, but I think it's harder to put in the first hour and drive the team around the pitch and marshal them. So for me, yeah, I think Crowley is still edging it at the moment, but as I say, not based on last night's performance.
I know I'm ping-ponging around here the whole time with that huge interpro against Leinster and the 27. Do you think it'll ever get to a stage where that game is just taken out of Thomond and then it's put into Páirc Uí Chaoimh for such a huge game?
It's a good question. I mean, it's already sold out. So there's definitely appetite there for it to go to Porky Quay potentially. I think they'd have to make some changes. You know, I don't know if you were at that last Munster game there, but there was no big screen and we couldn't even see the clock and the scoreboard. I think there's definitely some kind of logistical pieces to be dealt with there. But I mean, you know, speaking from the Cork perspective, it would be absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be great to have a game of that magnitude in Cork, because typically we get the URC games only in Virgin Media Park, obviously, because it's a smaller venue. So yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely something that, if it hasn't already been explored properly, it's definitely worth looking at.
Do you reckon it's just logistical, or do you reckon it's a bit of a lack of money? I mean, just from the outside in, the club seems to be in a bit of a shambles at the moment, I suppose, not helped with the managerial situation.
Yeah, I think that, look, it's been a really tough, I mean, even before Roundtree left, it's been a tough kind of 18 months for Munster overall. I think they've had purple patches, which is great, but it's not the consistency that we would have seen previously. So I think they're in a sort of building phase, and as I mentioned earlier, that long list of injuries makes that way harder. So it could be logistics. It could, I mean, as we know, politics plays a huge part in this as well. And I'd be curious to know what Leinster fans would think of it as well. So yeah, there's potentially kind of a few different spanners in the works there, but I suppose we'll have to wait and see if it ever gets worked out.
For that vacant managerial job everyone's talking about, maybe Mike Prendergast being the front runner, do you see him as such, or do you think it's going to be somebody else?
Yeah, it was interesting in one of the press conferences with Ian Costello. He actually said that they're not in any rush to hire a new head coach. He's of the opinion that between Prendergast, Leamy and himself, they kind of have the skills needed to keep Munster going. Now, whether, obviously, Prendergast and Leamy have both signed contract extensions, whether either of them has a really strong motivation to step up into that head coach role, I think that's really what you would need. I think it's not a lack of skills. I think it's all the extra things that come along with being a head coach. And I have to say, you know, Costello has been doing a great job, certainly in front of the media. He's a very measured kind of character. So I think Prendergast, he has the potential, certainly, you know, he wouldn't be where he is if he didn't. But there's a lot of debate going on around it at the minute, as you say. And also there's, you know, do you bring in a director of rugby? Would that person be from the outside? So I think, look, there's an awful lot to work out there. They brought in Chris Boyd as a consultant to maybe test that out. So I think the right kind of steps are being taken, but it was interesting to hear Ian Costello say that, look, we're going to take our time about this. There's no rush. It's already awkward having a coach leave this early in the season. So at this point, if it takes until the end of the year, then that's what they're willing to do.
Do you think it was a mistake to get rid of Graham Rowntree so early?
I don't think so. I think, you know, there were a lot of questions asked in the week after that about how the players were coping, etc. But actually, I think they've dealt with it pretty well. You know, I mean, there were, you know, a spate of obviously not very positive performances before Rowntree left. And I think it's improved, I would say, since then in general. Whether it's hard to say, obviously, whether having no single leader is difficult for the players, but you know, when Dermot Barron was asked about that, he seemed fairly comfortable with the situation that they had built up. So I don't think so. I think there were elements of that situation that had just become, you know, too negative for it to move forward positively is kind of the impression that I received. And it's a shame. Obviously, it's never nice to see someone go out like that, but I think it was probably the right move for the long-term future, certainly, of the team.
Yeah, speaking to Keith Urs, 2 or 3 weeks ago, he shouted Declan Kidney for the head coach role, but I guess one Munster fans might be interested as of yesterday, Felix Jones departed England as defence coach. Do you think there could be a move? I mean, Munster fans are going to speculate with anyone free and available at the moment, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's so many what ifs, and I think, you know, Felix has obviously done a fantastic job down in South Africa working with Razi Erasmus. He's obviously super familiar with Munster as a club. I don't think him coming in as a head coach makes perfect sense to me. Just given that he hasn't, I suppose, done it at that level, that would be my biggest concern there. I think Declan Kidney, it feels like such a throwback to me. You know, having grown up as a diehard rugby fan, I think that feels maybe like a not future looking enough step mm-hmm. to me. So I would have a few concerns there. I would have a few concerns, I think, with either of them stepping into that role. But there could certainly be a place for either of them, you know, depending on the structure that Munster decide to go with.
Just to go back to last night's game for a moment, Craig Casey took a knock during the game, didn't look great, and the news I just seen coming out there from the bulletins, it might be a good few weeks. How big of a loss is he going to be within this Munster setup now?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, he's a young player, but he's very much able to direct the pack around the pitch. He has obviously a really great partnership with Jack Crowley as well. He's just such a spark in the team. You know, he could kind of do anything at any moment. And as you say, it looked fairly nasty. He wasn't able to put any weight whatsoever on it looked like his knee coming off. And it's never good to see that. And I suppose my first thought actually was to the Six Nations, because as much as there's a battle at 10, there's obviously, of course, a battle at 9 as well. And I think Craig would be of the opinion that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe he should be getting the shout for Ireland more often. So to see him with an injury that could potentially impact his ability to do that, I think it would be really disappointing. So I suppose you just have to hope that they're able to do their best with him. And look, he's surrounded by fantastic medical staff. So fingers crossed it won't kind of stretch into that Six Nations phase. But that definitely was a big concern when I saw the kind of condition he was in going off.
Do you really reckon there's a big competition for the number 9 jersey? I mean, outside of DuPont, I'm probably struggling to think of a better scrum half than Jameson Gibson-Park, to be fair to him.
I think if you're looking forward, I think definitely Jameson Gibson-Park has been fantastic, obviously, for Ireland for a number of years now. But I do think, in the grand scheme of things, if you want Craig Casey to be at his best at that level, he's only going to get there with, you know, exposure to these big situations. Mm-hmm. So I think he can do it, obviously, at a level with Munster, but Ireland is another step up. And I think if we're going to future-proof the team, then certainly I'd be advocating for him getting more game time, if not more starts. It's obviously, you know, two different things, but yeah, I think he's ready for it. Obviously, this injury notwithstanding, I think he's got the raw skills there to do it.
Where do you now think the current state of Munster? No head coach, loads of injuries upon injuries. Where do you think they're objectives for the year now lie? I mean, you can't see them probably going that far in a Champions Cup. Do you think they'll get in the top 8 in the URC?
It's really hard to say, purely because, as I mentioned earlier, it's that word consistency that's lacking. They looked imperious against Stade last weekend. Things were working really well in attack, in defence, you know, the line out, the scrum, and to go from that to a performance like last night is concerning, to have that, you know, that swing between your level of performance. And, you know, yes, there were changes made to the team, but you still had heavy hitters out there like your Tadhg Burns and your Peter Romanis. And I think in scenarios where we're not able to get over the finish line with the quality that we do have, I think that's where I'm worried for our prospects. I think it's difficult to see, you know, if they put in a whole load more performances like last night, will they make the top mm-hmm. 8? No. If they go back to whatever was working for them against Stad, I would actually be quite confident in them maybe making a quarter final. I think it all depends on honing in on finding out what is going wrong there in terms of the lack of consistency. And if they can unlock that and figure it out, then there is potential there, certainly, I think, for this year still.
How do you think they get things back on track against Ulster?
If I knew that now, Dan, I'd...
you'd have the head coach role.
I know, yeah. I'd step in no bother. It's really hard to say. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, they put a very positive spin on it in front of the media, which is, of course, very understandable. But it's tough to know, like, as you said, without that head coach behind the scenes, what does that look like for the players? Are there any areas that's causing them to struggle? So I think certainly a few less injuries would be fantastic. And again, just finding that consistency, figuring out where the lack of skills is not translating to the performances that we know that these players can give, because they do it for Munster, they do it for Ireland on their best days. And it's definitely a conundrum. But I think as I said, Ian Costello's of the opinion that he's not in any rush, so we actually may not get an answer on this now for quite a while. Mm-hmm. Particularly, we're mid-season. A lot of coaches are contracted until the end of the season, so we may be waiting quite a while to get an answer to that question, to be honest.
Well, look, we'll wait and see and live in hope. Sarah McKenzie Foley, thanks so much for speaking. I was going to say speaking to us here on the Big Red Bench, as if you're not on the show tomorrow, like. But
I know.
All the best. Thanks so much. Yeah, interesting times on the Munster front indeed. Huge thanks to Zare for jumping on the call with me earlier. The ref's whistle has gone for a half time, but stay with us, as in the second half, we'll be hearing from snooker royalty in Dennis Taylor.
The Big Red Bench.
Cork, good times.
Red FM.
Welcome back to the Big Red Bench on Cork's Good Times, Red FM. Dan Casey here with you for the next 25 minutes. Earlier today, Premier League leaders Liverpool scored late on to rescue a 2-2 draw with Fulham, despite playing most of the match with 10 men, as Andy Robertson was sent off in the first half. Now, boss Aaron Slot was pleased with the performance, but not the result.
If you drop points in a home game against Fulham, that's definitely not what you expect and what you want. But yeah, being two times a goal down, so many things go against you, except for one thing, that is our players and our fans. That was outstanding today.
How long can Liverpool hold on at the top? Now we go to unusually a bit of snooker now, and next year marks the 40th anniversary of Dennis Taylor's incredible World Snooker Championship win. The Ulsterman defeated Steve Davis in an absolute thriller at the Crucible, winning on the final black ball in the final frame in 1985, with over 18 million viewers watching on TV when the match finished after midnight. Dennis and Steve will be in Cork in February for a series of exhibitions to mark the event on Tuesday, February 4th in the Blackrock Hurling Club, on Wednesday the 5th at the West Lodge Hotel in Bantry, and on the 6th at the Firgrove Hotel in Mitchelstown. The night will conclude of a 3-course meal, reenactment of the final frame on TV up to the colours, whereby they will be then laid out as if they were on the final frame. And tickets for the events will be available on ticketstop.ie, Blackrock Hurling Club or the Firgrove Hotel. Meanwhile, Rory has been speaking to Dennis about that incredible final in 1985.
All right, delighted to be joined on the line by a man who needs absolutely no introduction, Mr. Dennis Taylor. Dennis, it's a pleasure to talk to you. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Rory. How are you doing?
I'm good. I've been looking forward to speaking with you all week. I'm a massive snooker fan, so getting to speak to you is a genuine thrill. So slightly starstruck this morning, but I'm sure I'll get over that eventually. Come here. Before we get into, I suppose, the main topic for our conversation, which is the 1985 final, just want to mention, I suppose, the passing of Terry Griffiths recently, an absolute icon in the snooker world, a man I assume you knew quite well, and just a massive ambassador for the sport.
He was, and another Welsh legend, after Ray Reardon not so many weeks ago who passed away, two former world champions from South Wales. But Terry'd been poorly for a couple of years with dementia, bless him, and I managed to see him the day before he passed away, but he wasn't in very good shape. But I was there with with his son Darren, so I just happened to be down in South Wales, so it was great to just sit there, even though he didn't know we were there. We were reminiscing about, because his son and my son are the same age, and we used to go on holiday. We'd been to America, to Disneyland together, you know, Terry's family, Doug Mountjoy's family, and my family. We had 13 of us. We had a wonderful trip, and we were just reminiscing about the good old days, because I had a great match against Terry in the final of the World Championship. Looked like I was going to win it that year, 1979, and Terry outplayed me on the final day. But yeah, a great ambassador for the game, and well liked all over the world, because he was one of the top players that was interested in coaching. None of the rest were really interested, but Terry always had a love for teaching the game. So, and his son has carried that on. He's in Hong Kong teaching. So, yeah, an awful lot of players got quite a bit of help from Terry, including Mark Allen from Antrim, who worked with Terry for a few years.
I always loved him on commentary as well. He had such a great knowledge of the game and just a massive insight, and I suppose that transferred up to his coaching, as you mentioned.
Yeah, well, that Welsh accent, I mean, I remember bringing him over when the troubles were bad up in the north, and he would come over with me, no problem. Doug Mountjoy, Steve Davis, and everybody loved Terry, and I think it was that lilt, you know, the Welsh accent, and they all remember when he did get into that final in 1979, when he came out with that famous line to David Vine. He said, "I'm in the final now, you know." So it's not unlike the Cork accent. The Welsh accent,
very nice,
a nice yeah. lilt to it, lovely lilt to it. Yeah.
And that 1979 final, Dennis. I suppose, as you mentioned, you might have been expected to win that, but Terry eventually did win it. How much did that defeat, I suppose, spur you on in the following years?
Well, listen, I had a pair of contact lenses in that year. Up until that, I'd always taken my glasses off to play. I had pretty poor eyesight, but the lens made a vast difference. In fact, I beat Steve Davis that year. And then the great Ray Reardon, who had been six times a world champion, managed to defeat him. So I was a strong favourite to win that final against Terry. But Terry was an amazing match player, and he came through from the qualifying rounds to go on and lift the world title, the first player to do that. So it was quite an achievement for him to do that. But as I say, it always was a strong area of South Wales for top snooker players. But Terry was, he was right up there on the sort of same sort of lines. Played the game a bit like the great Ray Reardon. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Con, set up this interview with us to chat about the 1985 final, because you're coming to Cork to do some exhibitions with Steve.
Well, listen, it's always great to come to Cork, because it was one of the places, I think it was about 7 weeks after I won the World Championship, I was to go and do an exhibition in Cork. And it was supposed to be at Liam O'Connor's club, the snooker club. We'd fixed it before I won the world title. And Liam, God rest his soul, he decided, let's make something special. And we did it in the Neptune Basketball Stadium, and turned out having 3,500 people turn up. It was one of the, at that time, the biggest audience that had ever watched snooker. And I think it's probably, they may have had more people in Hong Kong for a match with Ronnie and Mark Ofu in a big venue there. But the Neptune was incredible. So it's always great to come back to Cork. And I did come back there with Steve Davis many years ago. And here we are celebrating 40 years of that black ball final, and we're doing shows all over the UK in theatres, and it wouldn't have been right if we hadn't have done a few shows over there. So we're heading over to Cork for three shows, and they'll be a lot of fun, because Steve is, I love working with Steve, because he's so funny. So we're there on the 4th. We're in the Black Rock Hurling Club. I'm sure you've got the details on the 4th, and then the West Lodge Hotel in Bantry on the 5th, and Fairgrove Hotel on the 6th at Mitchellstown there. So we'll have an awful lot of fun with the people over there, because Steve is so dry, and you know, we'll be reenacting that black ball final as well, which is which is great for me, Rory, because I get to pot the black every night.
You certainly do. I was watching it back this morning, that's the deciding frame, and just going up to pot that final black, Dennis, I mean, like, what's going through your mind? You got down in the shot pretty quickly. It seems like you didn't give yourself much time to think about it.
Oh, well, no, I got down quickly, but I didn't expect Steve to miss a black that he, that everybody thought he would cut in, but under that sort of pressure, he overcut it, which is what you can do, because you tend to hit a shot like that on the thick side, and he overcompensated, and I got to the table quite quickly, but I took ages to eventually let go of the cue and let the black disappear into the corner pocket, but, I mean, God, you wouldn't have thought 40 years later everybody's still talking about that. And it was just one of those finals that captured everybody's imagination. And Steve says he'd remember that more than the six that he won. So we were involved in a bit of snooker history that 40 years on people are still talking about.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, like, obviously Steve has, I suppose, softened in his stance on it. I mean, like, afterwards, I was watching his post-match interview with David Vine, and he just gave one-word answers afterwards. Understandably, he was upset, but he's obviously softened a lot on that final as the years have gone by.
Well, listen, that's why he dominated the game for 10 years, as Stephen Hendry did, taking over from him. He dominated the game in the 90s, but Steve Davis in the 80s, there's very few people could beat him. He kept himself to himself. He was fully focused. I always relate him a little bit to, for people that follow golf, a bit like Nick Faldo used to be, sort of focused and just, and that was Steve, but he's different. He always had a wicked sense of humour, but now it's coming out, and as I say, I love sort of commentating with him, but I also love doing the evenings because he makes me laugh no matter how many times we work together.
Going into that final, Dennis, I suppose Steve was the favourite. He'd won, I think it was the three of the last four. He was the defending champion. So the pressure was all on him. So did that play a part, I suppose, coming into that final?
Well, funnily enough, I got through to the final and a session to spare in the quarterfinal and a session to spare in the semifinal. So I was flying. I was playing brilliant stuff. So Steve had beaten me the year before in the semifinal, but as I say, I managed to beat him in 79. So I always played quite well at the Crucible the times that we played each other. So I was looking forward to it. But I'll tell you what, even though I was in top form, I never got a shot. I sat in my seat for the whole of the first session. He never looked like missing. 7-0 he beat me, and then he won the first frame in the evening, 8-0, and then I got the first frame on the board, but he was 9-1 in front, and somehow I kept him in his seat for the last six frames, and all the six frames I won was mainly with one chance, so I really hit good form, but nobody gave me much of a chance when I was 9-1 behind, and including myself. But I thought, listen, you haven't done much wrong, just hang in there, keep playing, and snooker's like that, only one player can be at the table, so if you can keep the other fella in his seat, you've always got a chance. But to be only two behind and into the final there, then that's when I knew I was right back in the final.
Yeah, exactly. And getting down to that deciding frame then, I suppose it is anyone's game at that stage, but the pressure must have been enormous on both of you, Dennis.
Well, I mean, the last frame, people say it's the greatest frame snooker ever seen because of the final frame. If it had been the first frame of the match, it would have been a terrible frame because we were missing pots, but it was the pressure that was causing to miss the pots. The safety was excellent. But nobody thought we'd get down to the last four colours, which I was going to need, and then to eventually just go to the one ball to decide it after being 17 days at the Crucible Theatre, decided on one black ball. And at that stage, everybody was tuning in, and there was nearly 19 million after midnight. I mean, that was amazing. And some of the stories you hear from people, all over, well, all over the world, in fact, but, you know, where they were, they all seem to remember where they were that night, and a lot of youngsters were allowed to stay up, and a lot of them were late for school the next day, but, you know, it was one of those that captured the imagination of the whole of the UK and Ireland. It was incredible, really.
Yeah, it certainly did. And my dad's from Derry, and he was so proud of an Ulsterman winning the World Snooker Championship. He was just so proud. I think that was kind of the feeling, I suppose, all over Ulster and Northern Ireland and the whole entire country of Ireland as well. It was very, very special. Were you aware, I suppose, of the support you had back home in that final?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, listen, I've always travelled. I mean, I moved away from England from Ireland when I was 17. But no matter where I travelled in the world, you're always an ambassador for the game of snooker, but you're also an ambassador for your country. And, you're so proud to have won it. I mean, Alex had won the world championship, which was unbelievable, in 1972 and again in 1982. Alex Higgins was unbelievable. And I used to practice. Alex moved over to Blackburn, where I was based. I met Alex when he was 17. And then practiced a lot with him in the early days before he won the world championship. So, you know, learned a lot from him. But to have three world champions coming from Ireland, as indeed Wales did have as well, is amazing. And you're proud for yourself, your family, but also for where you come from. And there's a lovely little story talking about being able to go to all sections of the community when we were talking about Terry Griffiths. Lovely wee story. I had Terry over in Derry. You just brought it back mentioning Derry. And Terry was there, and also Cliff Thorburn. And as I said, Cliff didn't really know, because we'd play in a Catholic club, a Protestant club, it didn't matter, different clubs. So Cliff, the Canadian, was there one night, and he just said, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, a great pleasure to be here in Londonderry." Oy. And it went very, very quiet, and I said to Cliff, so that everybody could hear, I said, "Cliff, that's tomorrow night." And it brought the house down. So, yeah, we used to have so much fun up in the north of Ireland when things were pretty bad, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
But anyway, that back, I diversified there, but back to the final, yeah, to finish up just knocking that final black in, it was hard to describe. And the fact I was stamping the cue on the ground after I raised it above my head, I suppose, and stamped it on the ground and then wagged my finger. So that's the three things, Rory, even to this day, that people do. I was with Ken at a big charity lunch in Manchester last week, and there were 600 people there, and we were having photographs. If anybody's got a pair of glasses on, they wanted to turn them upside down for the photograph, or they wanted to raise an imaginary cue above their head or wag their fingers. So, you know, I never get fed up with people wanting to do that.
Brilliant. I'm sure you'll have plenty of that in Cork now in a few weeks' time. But one thing that struck me, Dennis, watching bits of the match back this morning, was just the atmosphere in the Crucible. I mean, like, the silence was deafening every time, like, yourself and Steve were standing over a shot, but just the roars of encouragement for both players afterwards. There's something very, very special about the atmosphere in the Crucible.
Well, it only holds, 970 people, and even the people on the back row, they're so close to you. And, well, especially when there's two tables there, they're so close on the front row that they could grab your cue when you're on the cushion. So, but when it gets to one table, that's when the Crucible comes into its own. And I know they're talking about moving it possibly in 27, when that's supposed to be the contracts up with the Crucible Theatre, but all the players wanted to stay there. Barry Hearn said as long as he was alive, it would stay there, but there's rumours that it might leave it, but I hope not. The only thing that I say, you know, when we do these dinners and we're chatting different questions, I say to people, you know, when they raise that question about leaving the Crucible, I said, well, rather than take it to another country or whatever, why not to do it like the golf? Still have the Crucible as the home of snooker, but then one year take it to Ireland, another year take it to Wales, then take it to Scotland, and then have it back again at the Crucible and still keep it as the home of the World Championship, a bit like the Open Golf. Mm-hmm. Just an idea that I'd rather see that happen than just take it away to Saudi Arabia or some other country.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic.
China, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it would be fantastic to get a big tournament back to Ireland. I was chatting with Angus McAnally a couple of months ago about the Irish Open and golfs, and I suppose all the great matches that were there. It'd be fantastic to get a big tournament back in Ireland.
Well, wouldn't it be great? Can you imagine having the World Championship, you know, possibly in Dublin or you know, somewhere there? But, you know, probably if they did do that, I don't know whether they ever will. It was just a suggestion that I thought might possibly be an alternate, but the powers that be will decide that when the tar. Just hope that I'm still around when they finish at the Crucible, if they do.
Talk to me about the aftermath of the 1985 final, Dennis, and I suppose how much your life changed after you won.
Yeah, well, I mean, just everybody's concept of how it happened and how I won, it was amazing. It didn't change my life in regards to, I was still living in the same house and still, you know, but it was just the fact that the way I won it that captured the imagination of everybody. And I remember being in London a few days after it, and taxi drivers in London, very rarely do you get a great reaction from them, but the fella stopped the taxi and started calling all the other taxi drivers around, so there was a bit of a traffic jam with taxis sort of all shaking hands and waving at me. Now, you never get that sort of response, so sorts of things like that. And as I mentioned, the Neptune basketball stadium for 3,500 people to turn up, you know, that everybody just seemed to, you know, if you were making appearances, they just like to be there and just congratulate you. So it was with that respect. And when you travel around the world and be introduced to there's nothing, no better feeling than being introduced as the current world snooker champion wherever you go. But the fact that I won a very special one was made it even more rewarding.
I imagine it's hard to believe it's 40 years, Dennis.
Oh, I know. I can't believe it. When Steve and me chat about it, it's we can't believe we're still talking about it. So, as I say, this is the big one, the 40th one. So we're gonna make a bit of a fuss about it. We're going back to the Crucible Theatre as well, and that's not until April. I think it's the second week in April before the World Championship, and that's sold out already. So let's hope we get some nice crowds over in Cork when we're over there at the venues, and we'll have an awful lot of fun with the people.
Yeah. Sounds like it's going to be a cracking night. Blackrock Hurling Club, Tuesday the 4th of February. West Lodge Hotel in Bantry, Wednesday the 5th of February. And the Firgrove Hotel in Mitchellstown, Thursday the 6th of February. And as Dennis mentioned, they're going to be replaying the final four balls of that decisive frame of 1985. It's going to be a cracking night. A three-course meal as well. Tickets can be got on ticketstop.ie. Dennis, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, sir. Really enjoyed our chat, and looking forward to catching up with you at one of the events.
Yeah, we look forward to that, Rory. All the best to you.
Dennis, thanks for that, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rory. Not a Check problem. We'll see you then.
All right,
see you
in a couple of months. Bye-bye.
And you, all the best. Cheers.
Bye.
And that's all we have time for here on the Big Red Bench. Huge thanks to all of our contributors. Dan Casey signing off, but fear not, Marty Guilfoyle is on the way next.